Welcome to the Gila Members Community Radio Show, Earth Matters. Earth Matters brings you in-depth coverage of local, state, and national environmental issues. We want to inform, challenge, engage, and inspire you. Three hosts alternate weekly shows to bring you a broad range of topics and expertise. I'm Dr. Kim McCrary, Southwest Regional Director and Staff Scientist with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance and your host for today's show. The New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, also known as NM Wild, is a grassroots organization dedicated to protecting and restoring New Mexico's wild places through advocacy and education, and ultimately legislation. We're also a conservation partner with the Wildlands Network, and as it just so happens, my guests today are Kim Vicariou, Western Director and Western Wildway Network Initiative Coordinator with the Wildlands Network, as well as Trek West adventurer, writer, and editor John Davis, co-founder of the Wildlands Network. Well, I'd like to welcome you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kim.
And I have to say I'm really excited to have you on today's show. Right up here in the very beginning, what I'd like to do is ask both of you if you could share something about your respective backgrounds with our listeners. So, John, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Since this is a show inspired and guided in part by New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, I'll mention that I've been working very closely with the great conservation leader Dave Foreman for more than 25 years now. He's really a mentor and almost an honorary uncle to me, and I helped co-found the Wildlands Project, as it was then called, more than 20 years ago with Dave Foreman and some other conservation visionaries. So my background in conservation is in part working with some great wilderness leaders like Dave Foreman, Michael Soule, Reed Noss, John Turborg, and others.
And I should say that Dave Foreman is actually on the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance board, all right? So
yes.
I should say that, yes. Kim?
Well, I've been working with Wildlands Project and network for about the last 15 years. I've worn many hats, mostly related to communications work. It's been a real extension of my life, really, because prior to that, I was a newspaper publisher and of a sort of what you might call a sort of progressive rag, as they call these things, and for many years I did that, and so I really had a great opportunity in my life to talk about conservation issues and use my communication skills.
Wonderful. So Kim, what is the history and mission of the Wildlands Network?
Well, to make it very short, our goal is to create a system of connected wildlands throughout North America, and that entails very broad thinking because these connected wildlands or wildways, as we now call them, can stretch for many thousands of miles, as John is now showing with his trek here in the Western Wildway.
And that's a perfect time for me to say, so why Trek West? I mean, Trek West is this groundbreaking 5,000-mile journey for the wilds of the West. Why Trek West?
Trek West is partly a personal adventure. I love exploring wild places on foot and in rafts and on skis and occasionally on bicycles. But more important, it's a conservation mission. We're trying with Trek West to promote the idea of protecting wildlife corridors, or more broadly, we're trying to promote the idea, we are promoting the idea of a Western Wildway, which some people know as a spine of the continent conservation corridor. So what I'm doing is I hike through and paddle through wild places. I'm taking photographs. I'm writing about these places. I'm tagging along with the regional conservation leaders who are working to protect these places. And I'm trying to help the conservation partners get the word out about the importance of not just protecting wild places, but reconnecting them and protecting enough land in a connected enough way that the full range of biological diversity can thrive, including wide-ranging animals like wolves, pumas, jaguars, and so forth.
So I was going to ask you, why are continental wildways critical? I mean, can you talk about that a bit more?
Several reasons. One, many species, again, especially the wide-ranging carnivores like wolves, pumas, jaguars, and bears and so forth, need to range widely during the course of their lives. They need to range widely to find mates, to find food. They sometimes move altitudinally or even latitudinally with the seasons. Of course, birds migrate immense distances. You know, many animals simply need to move long distances in order to meet their yearly and seasonal needs, and in order to maintain genetic diversity. There needs to be mixing between populations. But as well, in this climate change century, we are going to see more and more species needing to move upward in elevation or northward in latitude to stay within their climate envelopes. So many of us believe that wildlife corridors now need to be not just local and regional, but continental in scale, so that animals can move northward as the climate warms.
So the Western Wildway, as it's currently conceived, what is it spanning? What area does it span?
Ideally, the Western Wildway would take in much of the Sky Islands region, the Rocky Mountains, and adjacent deserts and grasslands. And it would not all be public land. In fact, much of it would be private land. And there would need to be very strong incentives for good private land stewardship. Any continental wildway in North America will depend on a mix of public land ownership and good stewardship of private lands.
And you were talking about why they were critical. You were talking about species that cover large areas. Could you tie this in with what has been called the sixth great extinction?
Yes, we are in the midst, as Dave Foreman, again, of New Mexico Wilderness Alliance and a co-founder of the Wildlands Project, has written about this extensively in Rewilding North America and others of his books. We are in the midst of an extinction crisis. It's not even publicized in the mainstream media, but arguably, at least, the biggest crisis in the world today, even bigger than climate chaos, in my opinion, is the extinction crisis. We're losing hundreds of species, perhaps thousands of species a year, most of them little-known species, perhaps beetles that live in the rainforest canopy. But these are vital parts of our natural ecosystems. And if the worst-case scenarios that conservation biologists have painted come true, we may lose a third of biological diversity, a third of the species on the planet in the next couple centuries. This is a biological meltdown. It's a catastrophe that almost no elected official is paying any attention to. And we're losing all these species because of habitat fragmentation, habitat destruction, and, frankly, human overpopulation.
And you did mention cougars. Mm-hmm. You mentioned wolves. And so I was just wondering if you would take a moment to explain to people why those animals are examples of keystone species. What does that actually mean when we say keystone species?
That's a good question, Kim. I first would want to emphasize that I think we should save all native species for their own intrinsic value. I think that wolves and cougars and jaguars and bears and raptors and trout and salmon and so forth have a right to their natural ecosystems just like we do. So I think that the biggest reasons for saving these wild creatures are ethical and intrinsic. But as well, many of these big predators play vital regulatory roles in their ecosystems. For instance, if you remove wolves from ecosystems, as has happened in much of North America, unfortunately, the ungulates, the browsers that they eat, then multiply to unnatural numbers and overeat the vegetation. So here in the West, where wolves have been removed, elk have multiplied beyond natural numbers and are then browsing down the riparian areas and the aspen groves and so forth, and preventing regeneration. Where I live in the East, the most needed reintroduction, in my view, is the cougar or the panther, the puma. It's all the same cat. They've been extirpated from most of the East. You still have them here in the West, thank goodness. In the East, the cougar has been lost from all but a small fraction of its original habitat. And as a consequence, deer are multiplying to highly unnatural numbers, and they are browsing down the forest. There are places where the eastern hardwood forest is literally not regenerating because of deer overbrowsing. And now we're seeing the proliferation of diseases such as Lyme disease, partly because of the overabundance of deer. I'm a victim of Lyme disease myself. Thankfully, I was treated and got over it, but many people are not treated in time. Lyme disease is a much, much greater threat to people than are all the native carnivores in the country combined. And Lyme disease tends to be worse in areas that have lost their top predators.
So, Kim, John was just telling us about the threat of disease because things are out of whack, so to speak. You know, the balance of nature is, in fact, not balanced. And we can certainly see that that's one reason why people should care about connecting wild places and balancing nature. Can you talk a bit more about why everyone should care about what you're doing, including urban dwellers? So people that really may not spend that much time in wild places.
Well, this is the crux of the issue, and it really does boil down to what Trek West is all about. As we look to our leaders in Washington, D.C. to help us maintain balance in all sorts of social situations, protecting our climate and our environment is very important. And I've certainly grown frustrated over the lack of action that's coming out of Washington, D.C. these days regarding climate change and regarding habitat protection. And one of the things that we've determined in crafting Trek West is that we have to come up with a new way to communicate the urgency of protecting habitat with all Americans, including urban dwellers. And so Trek West then is our effort to address that. And of course, we have recently completed a Trek East as well that John has mentioned.
And how many thousands of miles was that trek, and where did it start and where did it end?
Trek East started in it started in the Florida Keys, and it ended in the Gaspé Peninsula of Quebec, and I think it was around 7,500 miles. But back to the issue of why we're doing Trek West, we found that if we can incorporate exciting outdoor adventure into the conservation protection equation, that we're going to be able to get a lot more interest on the parts of folks who may or may not spend a lot of time thinking about conservation, but who will be exposed to conservation issues simply because they like the idea that an outdoor adventurer is trekking over dangerous terrain, exciting adventures that he's occurring, seeing wild species, and all the other aspects of outdoor trekking that John has done such a great job of incorporating conservation awareness into.
Well, this is Earth Matters, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Earth Matters, and my guests today are Kim Vicariou, Western Director and Western Wildland Network Initiative Coordinator with the Wildland Network, and Trek West adventurer John Davis, co-founder of the Wildland Network. Now, we were talking about continental wildways when we took a station break. And Kim, how many continental wildways have been identified so far?
Well, so far and these have actually been in place now for the concept for these has been in place for almost 20 years. And we do have four that we've been talking about at every aspect. That would be the Pacific Wildway, which stretches essentially from Baja California all the way to British Columbia. We have the Western Wildway, which is where Trek West is occurring, which stretches from the Sierra Madre Occidental in northern Mexico all the way to Alaska through British Columbia, etc., along the Rocky Mountains and associated ranges in the west. A third continental wildway is the Boreal Wildway, which actually runs east-west across the northern portion of Canada. Another and the fourth wildway is the Eastern Wildway, where John trekked in 2011, which stretches from Florida to Quebec.
So these continental wildways are grounded in science. And so what's the science behind it? Or in other words, how are wildland networks designed? What kind of information is actually used? And I would open this up to both John and Kim, any information that you could give us.
I'll start, and then Kim, you fill in because you'll remember more of the more of the details. But first I would say the basic book on continental wildways is Dave Foreman's Rewilding North America, and he indeed paints a vision for these four major wildways, Pacific, Appalachian or Atlantic, Rocky Mountain or Western, and Boreal. Some of us have urged Dave, and he's quite open to this, to add a fifth and maybe even a sixth. The Great Plains looks like another potential continental wildway. And surprisingly, the Gulf Coast, the coast along the Gulf of Mexico, may be yet another potential continental wildway. And that one, like the Boreal, would run more or less east-west. And why conservation scientists have been talking about the need to protect and reconnect big wild spaces it stems in part from a sub-discipline of conservation biology called island biogeography. E.O. Wilson and others did early studies showing that when you fragment habitats, when you essentially isolate wildlife habitats, species start to wink out for a whole host of reasons, from genetic inbreeding to disastrous events like storms that may wipe out the whole block of habitat if it's small and fragmented. So conservation science has been saying for decades now that it's not enough to protect pocket reserves. Wild places need to be big and they need to be connected, otherwise you lose many species. Over time, it doesn't happen right away, but over time you begin to lose species. As well, big connected places are essential for, as I mentioned before, for the wide-ranging animals like wolves, cougars, and so forth. And again, these animals, these top predators, play vital regulatory roles in their ecosystems. Kim, why don't you add to that?
Well, I think, first of all, it's real important when we're talking about wildlands network designs and wildways, because these areas are so big. And when you look at them on maps, you might ask the question, well, why would you create a wildway that would actually have a city in or near it? And it's a good question that people ask, but the answer to that is that, of course, these wildways, as you see them on maps, will not be 100% full of wildlife corridor activity. Clearly, there's no sense in including urban areas in any of this type of...
So you're not proposing to have wolves and cougars and bears walking down the middle of some city downtown, okay,
You got that right. but it's a question that comes up, and it's important to acknowledge that these wildways actually, in the end product, will resemble more of a mosaic pattern of different types of land management areas, as John alluded to earlier. But I just wanted to make that clear that this is a completely voluntary thing when it comes to private land ownership being inside these wildways, and landowners can opt out of this if they like to. Otherwise, we encourage them to utilize either just new management techniques on their own, or consider a conservation easement or other type of protection for their private lands, which in every case is totally voluntary. So I just wanted to make that clear.
Well, how many years of science is actually behind this? I mean, can you kind of give our listeners an overview of the contribution of science to actually designing these wildways?
Many, many decades of science underlie the Wildlands Network designs that Wildlands Network and other groups have formulated. One of the first widely accepted conservation area designs or Wildlands Network designs was done by Reed Noss, another co-founder of the Wildlands Network, in the early 1980s for the state of Florida. He and his PhD advisor, Larry Harris, designed a Wildlands Network for Florida, which has proven remarkably effective. The state of Florida, when it was under wiser management, actually essentially adopted Reed Noss's conservation vision for the state and used it to set state land acquisition priorities. And largely as a result of that, hundreds of thousands of acres, perhaps even millions of acres at this point, have been protected through acquisition or conservation easement in the state of Florida. So there's a long track record of Wildlands Network designs actually improving public policy.
So when these networks were designed, they considered road networks, human settlement, animal movement. So they looked at a lot of different factors to actually come up with the final product, so to speak. Is that correct?
That is correct. If you're doing a wildlands network design, you want to factor in the habitat needs of focal species. It's really almost impossible to account for every species out there in your planning process. So what's typically done is you adopt 5 to 10 focal species, and you map their habitat requirements. You add special...
And John, I'm sorry, excuse me. And how are those species selected?
It's likely that a group or groups would choose several top predators because they range widely and they, in a sense, serve as umbrella species. If you protect enough habitat to provide safe conditions for cougars and wolves, for instance, you'll probably be protecting enough habitat to conserve the full range or nearly the full range of biological diversity. But to make sure you, in a sense, capture that full range of biological diversity, you also look at special elements, rare species of plants, for instance, and you add them to the reserve design. You also want to factor in the existing condition of the land, of course, because, you know, many cities happen to be in what was probably once the richest habitat in a region, but you can't very well include those in a wild core. On the other hand, you do want to capture, you do want to conserve as many of the ripe of the streams and riparian zones as possible, especially here in the West, where water is such a vital part of the community of life. So you do want to account for what's on the ground. Roadless areas are natural cores. You know, any big roadless area ought to be protected as wild core habitat, and that's usually incorporated into wildlands network designs.
And I want to continue asking along the lines of talking about the design of these wildways. Kim, land that's included, not all of it is pristine. And in fact, some of it would need to be restored. So if you can talk about just a bit about this idea, because not only does the Wildland Network want to establish these wildways to protect wild places, but also to restore areas. Could you talk a bit more about that?
Well, yes, I can. Before I comment on that, I did want to add one thing to John's comments that he just
please
made.
Do. Please do.
In as far as designing these wildway networks, climate change is a huge wild card in this issue. And even though we can use the most exacting science to identify relative boundaries for these potential wildlands network designs, it's often not clear as to where the additional landscapes might be located that wildlife might need due to unexpected climate change. So I just did want to add that fact.
That's an important point to make. Thank you.
And so therefore, we're now, when we look at these wildlands network designs, we're starting to look at, I wonder where else we might want to expand some of these areas to accommodate potential climate change effects. So I just wanted to make that clear. As far as restoration goes within these wildlands network designs, it's clearly a big part of the operation. And it obviously restoration applies to all types of lands, publicly managed and privately managed. And so we're working with as many organizations as we can to try to get them involved in the concept of large landscape connectivity as relates to restoration. So it is a big deal, yes.
Now, in the reading that I was doing, I noticed that the Wildlands Network has been kind of informing a wildlife habitat mapping exercise that the Western Governors Association is undertaking. Could you just fill us in, Kim, a little bit about that?
Well, that process is underway, and clearly we did provide Western Governors Association with all our Wildlands Network designs. And by the way, we have 6 of those, 5 in the Western Wildway and 1 that's been completed in the Eastern Wildway. And we have another one in progress in the Southeastern U.S., just to give you an idea. And as long as we're mentioning that, these Wildlands Network designs are long-term projects, and they're highly expensive, costing millions of dollars in many cases for each of those. And so these are very valuable pieces of science. And so the Western Governors Association was actually soliciting them from us, which we, of course, have provided them, which I think gave them a lot of basis for some of their initial work. I think they're I'm unclear about the exact status of the process that you referred to, them creating these habitat connectivity assessments. We obviously totally support this work. We're anxiously awaiting a finished product from them, and hopefully that will happen soon. But that's the status of that.
Well, Continental Wildways, I mean, it's certainly a grand vision, and I think it's very apparent to our listeners that it's really well-grounded in science. But there are undoubtedly a lot of challenges when it comes to, and you were alluding to that, Kim, one being cost, of course, for doing the assessments itself, and then there's implementation, restoration, so forth and so on. I'd just like to talk a lot more about that, actually, the challenges that you are facing, and in particular, if you could talk about the Western Wild Way that's being proposed. So, John, Kim, it's open floor here.
Well, I'll start and then have Kim fill in the many gaps I leave, because he's so good at that. I would like to begin, actually, by saying Michael Sule, another of the co-founders of the Wildlands Project, now the Wildlands Network, has been a leader in the effort to protect wildlife corridors and indeed to promote continental conservation for decades. And Michael is getting very frustrated. He will frankly admit to those of us who work closely with him that he feels some despair, that he's given most of his life to conserving big, wild, connected spaces, and he's just not seeing the changes on the ground that are needed. The conservation community is succeeding in protecting pieces of nature here and there, and that is to be lauded and applauded. That is great work. It needs to continue, but we're not protecting nature on a continental scale. We're not often enough connecting the wildlife habitats that we manage to protect. Michael has actually started talking about the need for some sort of national conservation corridors campaign where we would really raise the profile of habitat connectivity efforts, in part by broadening the tent. That is, trying to draw in not just committed conservationists and environmentalists, but outdoor recreationists, hunters, fishers, bird watchers, naturalists of all sorts, outdoor industry leaders from REI and EMS and Patagonia and so forth. I mean, Michael has pointed out there are really millions of people who ought to be supporting habitat protection reconnection efforts, and it's not happening. So he and others of us are wondering, and this is part of the reason for Trek West, how do we draw in more people? How do we make people realize what we're doing right now in the way of nature conservation is vital, but it's not nearly enough? One of the conclusions I came to during Trek East is that every grassroots conservation effort in the eastern part of the country is crucial, is important, is worthy, deserves everybody's support, but it's not adding up to nearly enough. It doesn't, the pieces are not connecting. They're not being tied together. So part of what we're doing with Trek West is, again, emphasizing our existing habitat protection efforts must continue, but they must be better connected and better coordinated. And we need to greatly enlarge the constituency of people who are working actively, taking actions to protect our wild places.
You're listening to Earth Matters, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Gila Members Community Radio Show, and you're listening to Earth Matters. I'm really fortunate today because we've been talking with Kim Vicariou, Western Director and Western Wildlands Network Initiative Coordinator with the Wildlands Network, as well as Trek West adventurer John Davis, co-founder of the Wildlands Network. Now, when we took a station break, we were talking about the frustrations that have people, scientists, feel in terms of getting something done when it comes to continental-wide conservation, the wild ways. And Kim, I know there was something you wanted to say before I took that station break, so please go right ahead.
Well, John was finishing up there describing very accurately how we need to make the transition between just simply talking to conservationists about the need for habitat protection to actually expanding the audience greatly to include everyone who, in fact, lives in these areas that are affected. One of the things that Trek West is doing is offering an online petition at trekwest.org that we hope all of you would visit and sign this petition. The petition itself is basically, I say yes to protecting wildlife habitat corridors. And if we can attain enough signatures on this petition that we can deliver to decision makers and the agencies and elected officials, it'll just add one more positive step toward transitioning toward a much broader audience.
You know, if I may, because, again, you have been talking about being able to connect to that broader audience, have you felt that you've had any success connecting with any politicians in Washington, D.C.?
Well, absolutely, and I certainly don't mean to infer that all politicians are unaware of the need for the urgency of habitat protection. One example is Congressman Raul Grijalva, Democrat of Arizona, who at a recent Trek West event in Tucson actually endorsed our effort with Trek West, and so we were extremely happy to hear that. In addition, another Arizona Congressman, Ron Barber, has also endorsed Trek West and what we're trying to do with these large landscape habitat connection projects. So, and there are obviously others in Congress as well and in the Senate who certainly would be friendly to this type of an effort. Unfortunately, they're in the extreme minority. And so this petition that I mentioned might be another tool for us to begin to enlighten the entire body there of elected officials of the urgency of this.
So, in essence, you're emphasizing the importance of this really being a grassroots movement to help, shall we say, propel continent-wide conservation.
No question about it. If our congressional representatives are not moving on this, we as people can move on this. And we can take actions, especially in the area of private land management, that can simply move forward without any type of congressional approval. So that's what we're hoping for.
All right. That's a perfect segue for me because you, both of you, both John and Ken, both of you have alluded to the role that private property owners can play. And I will say that in Grant County, as well as Catron County, there are some people that have really that really oppose a Western Wild Way. They feel that it's going to lock up the land, push the people off the land. I've even read some where some have said that it's actually a movement having these wild ways to abolish private property rights. Now, I know you've mentioned that private property owners can participate or can opt not to participate. And could you talk about that a bit more? How would you respond to those that are opposed to what it is that all of us are really trying to accomplish, I hope?
Sure, I'll start, John, and you can chime in. well, first of all, this has been a lengthy struggle, more or less, attempting to bring the facts to the table about these types of proposed landscape habitat protection programs. First of all, these are simply suggestions that Wildlands Network and our partners are making about how to protect landscapes. These have nothing to do with legal ramifications that might affect a private landowner, because the only way that a private landowner could be involved in this is if he voluntarily agrees to be involved. There's no pressure on any private landowner to do anything related to these proposals. We certainly highly suggest and recommend that they consider taking certain steps in their management of their lands to assist the movement of wildlife across those properties.
And also, and could you again expand on why would it be advantageous for a property owner to want to do that?
This is a crucial question, and it's one reason why we will have to explore financial incentives and perhaps even policy changes. Because unfortunately, right now, in general, landowners in much of the United States are not rewarded for good for private lands conservation. I personally own land in the Adirondacks in northern New York. I preserve it as strictly preserve it as wildlife habitat. I donated a conservation easement to a regional land trust. I get no tax break for that. In fact, if I wanted
you get no tax break at all.
I was able to get a deduction on income taxes temporarily for the value of the donation I made to the land trust. So there was that financial benefit. But once that was used up, I'm assessed full property taxes on my land, even though I'm strictly conserving it as wildlife. Whereas if I wanted a tax break, I would have to log the land. So there are a lot of perverse incentives on private landowners in this country, often at the county or state level, not necessarily at the federal level, but it's a national problem. Landowners are not rewarded in our country for doing the right thing for wildlife. We need to change that. We need to make it so that landowners benefit financially and otherwise from conserving their wildlife habitat and allowing wide-ranging animals to move through their habitats. Any continental wildway will depend very heavily on good private land stewardship. There's just no way around that.
Is there any sort of effort being made to try to get the wheels rolling, so to speak, to make those changes?
Yes, I'm on the board of directors of a great little group called the Wild Farm Alliance, which is exploring wildlife-friendly forms of farming and ranching, and is having some good effects. They're getting the ideas out there. Author Dan Imhoff wrote a great book 10 years ago or so called Farming with the Wild, where he profiled some of the great conservation ranchers in the West, like Valair and Josiah Austin and Hadleys and so forth. And these people are conserving wildlife habitat very effectively and yet using the land. It is possible to use land, make an income from it, and yet conserve it as wildlife habitat. And again, I think that the example of the Austins in Arizona and New Mexico and Diana Hadley and her family in the New Mexico Boot Heel in southeastern Arizona, they are doing the right thing for wildlife even as they manage their private lands.
And can you give us some examples of what it is they are doing?
Well, a lot of what the Austins have needed to do on their lands in southern Arizona and northern Sonora is restoration, because the lands were badly degraded by decades of heavy livestock grazing, logging, water diversions, and so forth. So they've been building small check dams to slow the erosion and to help raise the water table. So they've been exercising active restoration across their couple hundred thousand acres of lands very effectively, I might add. They have their habitats, their lands are quite rich in wildlife habitat now. You see more water on El Coronado Ranch on the west side of the Chiricahuas, for instance, than I've seen almost anywhere else in the Southwest. And I think likewise, some of the other conservation landowners in the that Four Corners area where Arizona, New Mexico, Sonora, and Chihuahua come together are practicing some very effective forms of restoration and bringing fish back to viable numbers.
And John, again, this is partly what Trek West is all about. And Kim, maybe you can speak to this again, even if we repeat ourselves here. But you, during your trek so far from Sonora, Mexico, you've actually visited with these people, stopped to see what they're doing. And then what you've done is, because I notice you have a blog, which I'll be asking you about later so folks can follow you as you continue on your journey. But what you do then is that you share your experience with the public at large so they can see that there are private landowners on the ground that are in fact participating and recognize the importance of continental wildways such as the Western Wildway.
That's correct. And another aspect of Trek West is the fact that throughout the campaign, which actually will be going on for another 9 months or so, we have scheduled many major sort of media events at which the public is invited, one of which you recently had here in Silver City. And so if you as a private person would be interested in actually seeing some visuals of this, hearing a presentation from John, you can check trekwest.org and get an idea of where these events might occur in your area and where you can actually physically show up and enjoy some of these stories.
It's time for a station break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Earth Matters, and we've been talking about Trek West, this incredible 5,000-mile trek from Mexico to Canada to highlight the critical importance of continental wildways I wanted to, before we continued, I just wanted to read a quote and then ask a question after that. The father of wildlife conservation management, and perhaps we could say the U.S. wilderness system, Aldo Leopold once said, quote, "We abuse land because we regard it as a commodity belonging to us. When we see land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect." So, John, I want to ask you, how does your journey, your trek west, relate to changing our view of nature? I mean, historically, we've kind of looked at it as conquering nature rather than being part of the natural world.
I think Aldo Leopold was right there, as he almost always was, and I think that the trek that we are doing, I say we because I'm the one person actually physically trekking the whole distance, but this is very much a team effort involving many conservation groups. I think part of what we're trying to do with this trek is remind people that nature is fun and exciting and beautiful and worthy of our every bit of veneration and admiration and indeed love. And I'm having a great time out there hiking and wading across rivers and climbing mountains and so forth. And when I climb a mountain, I don't see it as conquering the mountain. I see it as an activity I do with the mountain. It's a shared experience. So I'm trying to convey the idea that we shouldn't try to conquer nature, and that when we exploit nature, we should do so as gently as possible, and that we should admire and love our fellow residents of this great land. I'm trying to show it to be fun and beautiful, and I want to draw in more people to remember that it's great. We really are not a whole people if we are not connected with nature. So part of Trek West is about reconnecting wild places. Part of it is about reconnecting people with wild places.
So one thought, the next time you sit down in front of your computer to view a wild area on Google Earth, for example, turn your computer off and put on your hiking shoes and come out and join John on the trail, or at least do a little hiking on your own. That's really what Trek West is all about.
So let me ask you, if people do want to join you, and I personally know people that are joining you, and that's fantastic. I wish I could go as well, but I can't. How can they get involved? How can they walk with you?
Well, I wish you could hike with me, Kim. Maybe you can farther down the spine. People can go to trekwest.org to find the itinerary. And Kim, if you don't mind me saying, I think you're orchestrating this great adventure. I think you're willing to receive emails and phone calls from folks who are interested in physically joining the trek. And parts of this trek will be solo, but many parts, perhaps even more than the solo parts, will be with friends, colleagues, and conservation scientists and naturalists. The most educational parts of the journey for me are when I'm tagging along with a naturalist or a scientist or a conservation leader who really knows the land. I'm not an expert on any particular region here, but I'm trying to get a sense of the whole.
Now, John, you've covered some 600 miles or so since you started, and I know you started in Mexico, as we said earlier. And you know, you've been talking about wide-ranging critters. So in essence, you're a wide-ranging critter. You're experiencing that firsthand yourself. And you certainly have to have found some barriers along the way to wildlife movements, whether it be the border fence, or another one that comes to my mind is I-10 cutting across the playa west of Lordsburg, New Mexico. How can connectivity be maintained with our labyrinth of roads and with barriers like what's happening in the border area?
First, a positive example. I began the trek in the Northern Jaguar Reserve, which is a terrific conservation project led by the Northern Jaguar Project and Naturalia. I trekked through that area partly on foot, partly on horseback, saw tracks of puma, jaguar, ocelot, coyote, and other great creatures, had a wonderful time. That is a great success story. 50,000 acres strictly preserved as wildlife habitat, and then strong incentives for the surrounding landowners to also conserve their habitat and allow the big cats to live. The Northern Jaguar Project actually compensates ranchers around the Northern Jaguar Reserve for getting photographs of living jaguars and the ocelots and other wild animals rather than killing the animals. And it's a great success. But as I went north, I did start to run into barriers. One of them is Route 2, which cuts east-west across northern Mexico and has dangerously fast and heavy traffic and probably will be a growing impediment to wildlife movement. I hope that eventually wildlife crossings will be put on that major road. An even bigger barrier is the border wall. And I personally feel a little bit ashamed to be paying taxes to a government that is spending billions of dollars building a border wall that does not stop human movement, but does stop the movement of wild animals. It's a fiasco. It's a very, very expensive fiasco. And I hope that the American people will demand that their government stop building this wall and make the, in fact, start tearing it down. Or at most have vehicle barriers that stop motor vehicles, but that do not stop animals. Another barrier to wildlife movement is I-10, Interstate 10, running east-west from, or west-east from California to Texas. The Wildlands Network, Sky Island Alliance, and other groups have identified places along I-10 where safe wildlife crossings need to be put in. Kim and I looked at one of these places the other day, Steen's Pass, where the Pelencios cross I-10. Perfect example of a place that would benefit greatly from a wildlife crossing, a safe wildlife crossing.
So that's
crossing.
Just as you drive, if you're coming from Arizona, over the border and you start going up through that mountain range that's there before you descend on the playa, correct?
That's right. That's the Pelencios. It's one of the longest ranges in the south to north distance and a key wildlife corridor. It goes from the Sierra San Luis in northern Mexico up to nearly this area of New Mexico and provides a relatively wild corridor for habitat, but unfortunately it is bisected by I-10, and again, in Steen's Pass would be an excellent place to put in a wildlife bridge over the road so that animals can safely cross. By the way, these wildlife crossings in the long run more than pay for themselves because they not only save the animals of the wide-ranging, save the lives of the wide-ranging animals, they save human lives and they reduce collisions between drivers and wild animals.
So, Kim, I was wondering, because John was talking about these bridges, all right, can you kind of explain in such a way that our listeners can kind of envision what one of these bridges might look like?
Sure. There's several examples actually already in existence that you could track down to look at. One, and probably the most famous, is in Banff National Park in Canada, where I believe it's Highway 2 there as well, was creating all kinds of wildlife vehicle collisions. A vegetated overpass was created there. It's approximately 100 yards wide. And probably 200 or 300 yards long, onto which, via use of fencing along the highways, wildlife is funneled onto these bridges.
And they are actually using this crossing.
No question about it. All types of wildlife, and these are vegetated overpasses with elevated berms along the edge, so that wildlife cannot see the traffic passing below them. So it's, if you're standing in the middle of one of these, it seems as if you're in a wild location for any type of species that might be using that. But that's a general description.
Thank you for that, Kim, because I do have a very good visual image now about how a crossing would actually look. Now, John, you've trekking across, you've come through the playa, all right? Now you've hit the lower Gila box down there where the Chihuahuan Desert kind of meets the juniper pinyon pine, so you've got that ecotone. And I know you went walking and maybe some river walking in the beautiful Gila River. Unfortunately, upstream from that area, there is a proposed project to divert Gila River water. Can you describe, when you were walking through the Gila there, what you actually saw, how it looked, how it smelled?
The Gila Lower Box is a fabulous place. I thoroughly enjoyed my time there wading in the river. The river was running quite high. I guess there's quite a bit of snow melt now. So it was actually a bit challenging at times to wade in and cross the river. I forded it many times. I had a great experience of watching a troop of Codamundis bounding across one of the little side channels on the Gila Lower Box. Yeah, a diversion on the Gila River would be very, very foolish. It would be ecologically very bad for wildlife and very bad for downstream communities of all sorts. I think that idea ought to be shelved right away, and the Gila Lower Box ought to be fully protected. There are several wilderness study areas around the lower Gila Box, all of which richly deserve to be designated wilderness.
Now, as this show airs, you will have just finished your trek through the Gila Wilderness. And I'm not going to hide my bias. I think it is one of the most spectacular places in the lower 48th, along with the Boot Heel, because I've spent some time down there myself. And of course, in the Gila National Forest and Apache National Forest, we have the Mexican Wolf Recovery Area. And there has been an effort underway, and it continues, to establish a functional population of critically endangered wolves. And I'm just throwing that out because I know you've been talking about wolves on and off. So I just wondered, what are your thoughts about that?
I'm really looking forward to this traverse of the Gila Wilderness. I haven't been in that area in decades, and I will have the good fortune of being led by the great conservation biologist Dave Parsons, who helped institute successfully the Mexican Wolf Reintroduction Program. I very much hope that that program will succeed, that the wolves will prosper and multiply. It's been a tough time for them in the early stages because many of them have been shot or hit, but their numbers are a bit have risen a bit lately, and it's looking more promising. But we really need wolves throughout the West. They've been reestablished in Yellowstone. We really need them throughout the West. They are a key part of our natural communities and play a vital regulatory role.
Which I think I'll just go ahead and put a plug in here and say that it was really good news to hear that their numbers had increased. Unfortunately, the number of breeding pairs has declined. So as you've been mentioning, John, throughout this, the idea of increasing genetic diversity, enabling animals to disperse, to find other mates, to kind of mix up that gene pool a bit more, if you will. To me, when I try to imagine in my mind how many miles you're walking, you're hiking, you're rafting, you're biking, it truly blows me away. And I can only imagine that you've had some real adventures in your journey. And I was just wondering, because I know the show is going to come to an end shortly, but could you share with us maybe one really special experience and one really kind of dicey but in hindsight worthwhile experience?
Oh, there have been so many rich experiences, it's hard to know where to start. But I guess one I would note is the thrill of seeing native fish in the streams of Cuenca Los Ojos lands in northern Sonora. I don't know fish as well as I know mammals, and I actually had the rare privilege of holding in my hands five rare species of fish that are rebounding in numbers on the streams flowing through the lands that the Austins have protected. It was a great thrill to me, and it was especially nice because about the same time, another troop of Cotamundis bounded past.
They're following you.
I hope so. And then a slightly scary experience. I'm not experienced on horseback, but I've actually traveled a fair amount of the early part of the journey on horseback. And I was at one point on some precipitous slopes with disintegrating trails. And I had my full backpack as I was riding the horse, and I thought, if this horse takes one misstep, we are both dead. Thankfully, the horse was flawless, and we got to our destination quite safely. But it reminded me that there will be a few frightening experiences along the way, I'm sure.
And also, I'll just put a plug for four-legged critters there, since that one you were on was so sure-footed.
That's right. Absolutely.
All right, John, you've got this exciting journey you're on, and you're going to continue onward all the way to Canada. So how can our listeners keep tabs on what you're doing? How can they read about it, hear about it, find out about your adventures and misadventures, including in when you finish your trek or as you move on through the Gila?
Kim, you want to explain that?
Sure. Well, first of all, I would encourage everybody to go to trekwest.org and sign the petition there. And then also check out the maps, the trail maps, and all the other information that's available there about the numerous partners we have throughout the entire trek to familiarize yourself with the vast scope of this thing. And, you know, it's time that we all take action to protect wildlife habitat corridors, because it's we, the people, that are going to make the difference. And that's why this Trek West campaign is so important.
And Kim, indulge me, please. Could you give that web address again?
Sure. It's trekwest.org.
Well, I can tell you that I don't know about all of you out there, but I thoroughly enjoyed myself. I've learned a lot. I hope folks will go to trekwest.org. This is very important, not only for wildlife, two four-legged critters, but for us as well in terms of healthy communities, clean air, clean water, places to go where we can find solitude. So please follow John as he continues on his incredible 5,000-mile journey. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in to Earth Matters, a show about earthly matters that impact us all.